Well, hello again, everyone, and we are beginning with simultaneity and sequence number 3. It's still the 13th of February, just a little before this pre-full moon that I have to give shortly. So maybe this will be a little shorter program. We have been moving sequentially through this series of statements that I have made. Maybe we're about a third of the way through, I would say. And we came to some statement which asserts the perspective I'm trying to emphasize now. It's a very remote perspective, really, and one that seems very distant from our experience, our normal experience. But perhaps in deep meditation we can come closer to it. And the statement basically is nothing but absoluteness now. And that all other things that seem to be are actual in illusion, as it were, but not ultimately real, except for the fact that even illusion can be nothing else but the real. But at least the illusion seems to veil reality from our consciousness unless we can somehow see our way through that and learn how to be faced with multiplicity and still experience only the one. The oneness overcomes the sense of multiplicity, but still we can handle the multiplicity. And then I think we would be coming close to that state that we call isolated unity. It is the state in which the masters find themselves. It is a state which does not deny their practicality whatsoever, but constantly reveals the great unity and perhaps behind it the one great being who is all aspects of this harmonized unity. So we will now go on, and I'm continuing somewhat in the same vein, and I'm saying that next we will have perhaps a radical thought. Well, radical means going to the roots, doesn't it? And maybe a number of these thoughts have been oriented towards the root of things. Actually, the root being is the boundless, immutable principle. Is this absoluteness, infinite essentiality, okay, and ultimatization. If you start to pronounce those syllables incorrectly, they won't let you go. So here is a radical thought. I say, all that could possibly be, I've mentioned this before in a way, but it's different from what I emphasized in infinitization. All that could possibly be an infinitely infinite range of possibilities within the fount of all possibility is forever consummated in absoluteness now. Well, this is hard to imagine, that what has not yet occurred within the endless Mayavic sequence of the great breath has already been forever consummated forever. You know, it's as if we wish to have the ability to unfold something new, and of course to us it seems like something new, but within the absoluteness of deity, perhaps there has been the complete consummation of every combination, pattern, possibility forever. How that would work, well, we can speculate hopelessly on that another time. So all of this is forever consummated in absoluteness now. And absoluteness is ultimatized perfection now as forever, now as ever. Ultimatized perfection now, regardless of the seeming of things. No possibility can be excluded from absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization, or it, the absolute infinitude would not be infinitely complete. It would still lack something. It would still have something to gain, and it would never be the infinity of all infinities. Its state would be less than a still greater possible state, and this is not allowed of the infinitely infinite. Well, you can see whether you accept the possibility of this speculation, this hypothesis. Okay. So indeed, it is maybe the most counterintuitive of the thoughts that I have offered here. I'll say it again. All that could possibly be an infinitely infinite range of possibilities within the fount of all possibility, another name for that, is forever consummated in absoluteness now. Is it an articulated consummation? Or is it just that the very essence of things contains all possibility without necessarily outpicturing in self-objectification all possibility? Absoluteness is ultimatized perfection now as if it were forever, now as if it were ever. Absoluteness is ultimatized perfection now as forever, now as ever, and no possibility can be excluded from absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization. It is utterly, in this sense, beyond good and evil. Of course, the conditions that we call evil are such a small veil upon the infinite magnificence of the absolute reality. They seem horrible enough in our context, but I think are completely dwarfed by the infinite creativity of the ultimate one. So if any possibility were excluded from this absoluteness, then that, or the it, would not be infinitely complete, which we hypothesize it to be, infinitely perfect. Its state then would be less than a still greater possible state, and something could be added to it by external experience. But we want to say that nothing can be added to it through external experience. And of course, this runs counter to the way we think of our own growth as always becoming greater and greater. Well, of course, we have so much apparent time in cosmos that we can entertain that, and to a great extent, whatever we are will always seem to become greater and greater until we discover all along that we have been the universal logos. And that universal logos is a special case of that. And it reaches its own type of perfection before being, in time, reabsorbed into this ultimatized state. So, in an interesting sense, absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization, has nothing to do, per se. It is only to be itself, which includes all things, now as forever, now as ever. Its projection in an infinite series of universes, cyclically recurring from the perspective of time, has apparently an infinitude of processes to do. Once you have multiplicity, you have action. So with multiplicity, or we'll call it that, apparent multiplicity, comes action and doing, and the third aspect of divinity. And so later we will consider cyclic recurrence as a great actuality, as well as an unreality. How can something be an actuality and yet an unreality? Well, it depends on how we define our terms, but actuality is that which is presented to consciousness under the spell of Mahamaya, and reality is the infinitely interior state, which is completely homogeneous and is only itself and nothing else. All universes, I say here, may well be an ever-sustained one ultimate true point. Well, maybe I haven't said enough yet for that to make sense. So more on that anon. Even when one uses the word anon, one predicates a future. I certainly, we have to live as if time and space were realities. We have to improve this illusion of time and space until it reaches the intended design. But also, while we're doing that, the presence of the ever homogeneous one should be hintingly present to our apprehension, so that we realize that all movement is less than the immovable reality. Absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization is what all of us, as seemingly distinct beings, beings, essentially are. What are we essentially? This is what we are. Whatever words we want to use for it, I think maybe the Buddha simplified it. He just called it suchness. There was no way to predicate anything of it. Thatness, suchness, that. The essential. This is what we are. All of the us. And when we look at something that seems to have distinctness and difference, we have to learn how to convert it into the one essential substance. So when we look at anything distinct, we have to learn to convert it into the one essential substratum. Well, of course, we don't need to convert it at all. It's just an operation in consciousness. We have to learn how to see it as that. And that would be a great exercise, of course, to look at the amazing variety presented to our consciousness and somehow force whatever presentation it may be to undergo a radical conversion into essential substance, the essential substratum. Sometimes when I want to do that, I practice it, I just use the word same, same, until the feeling comes to me in my heart, mostly. At least the heart seems to be involved. It seems to catch the sameness of all things and to dissolve all things into sameness. That doesn't mean you can't deal with them as if they were distinct. But it allows you to begin to sense the overpowering homogeneity of essential substance. That's what it can do, and that's what we have to practice. So if we realize this, this will call for a radical change in our method of identification. We're trying to learn identification, which DK tells us is realization plus esoteric experience plus absorption into the whole. And so sometimes identification is a negative, like when we're identified with form, as if it were something real in itself and distinct. But to be identified with the substratum negates the self-reality of form and allows us to detach from that apparency, which is what, of course, we do have to learn how to do if we are ever to retract along our line of self-emanation and dwell within the realization of the One, to be the One. That, of course, is the great returning reward. Even now it may exist on some level for us, but we are dimensionally sealed away from a realization of that One. Now, we want to learn to be being, relearn it anyway. Well, we already are, but we want to relearn consciously to be being and carry that being of being with us in whatever we do. There's so many veils that can interrupt that process and so many habitual responses which are exactly opposed to that type of realization, but with practice in time, it can be done. So it seems that we, it would seem that we, the perceiver, whether the great perceiver, the universal logos, or one of the almost countless, I don't say entirely countless, but almost countless emanations have been experiencing sequence of perceptions forever. Yet the truth is, at least as I hypothesize it now, that we have been and will be absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization, now as forever, now as ever. Sequence, as long as any unit of the One Life experiences sequence, then in a sense the entire great being experiences sequence. And we will not escape from the impression of sequence. But then perhaps we don't really need to escape, because an aspect of ourselves which is alive and well in what dimension or non-dimension, who can say, is completely experiencing itself as absoluteness, infinite essentiality, and ultimatization. Now and forever, now as ever, now as forever. So there's a duality here that we will be faced with the Mahamaya, and in each universe we somehow learn to overcome the false assignment of reality to the Mahamaya. I think the time in which there is that false assignment is tiny compared to the duration when the false assignment no longer exists. Of course, you can ask, what were we as the monad doing before we became involved in this solar system and so forth? And that's not an especially answerable question, nor do we know how long the universe has really been occurring. The occult scales are so vast compared with the presently proposed scales of science, which propose something like 15 billion years to the age of the universe, which is far from the duration of even one solar system, according to the occult doctrine. But of course, then, we perhaps have to measure the dense physical plane's duration, and then consider the duration in time of all of the subtle aspects of the solar logos and beyond. I guess that the great lords of karma have to deal with such immense matters, and for us it's all the merest speculation, but tells us the direction in which we may be going as we continue to evolve through this solar system and beyond, through our local cosmic logos and beyond, through our local one about whom naught may be said. So perhaps we then can have some feeling for or intuition regarding what has been said so far. We need to transcend our customary experiences of what we call reality and achieve an experience which is radically different. So different that it appears in some ways to be outrageously nonsensical. But if the reasoning of a relatively sound type has led us here, then we cannot so quickly dismiss it as beyond the pale. In many ways, of course, it is beyond the pale. The pale is the fence, and the fence are all the boundaries that our concrete mind produces, and we shall shortly see that maybe we'll find another way to show that boundaries don't exist at all. So we have to transcend our customary experiences of what we call reality and achieve an experience which is radically different, the experience of absorption into the whole, as Master DK says, but I'll add here, absorption into the whole as the whole, realizing that as we are being absorbed into the whole, we're not the part at all, but have always been the whole into which the apparent self is being absorbed. So it's not any sense of egotism to consider oneself the whole. It's simply overcoming the limitations of the concrete mind, which always wants to put boundaries around the unbounded. So we will come into the experience of being ever greater wholes until we are convinced experientially of the fact of being the ultimate entirety. I try to give little different perspectives on this wholeness. You working with the imagination can help, you know, as you begin to imagine that which lies beyond your immediate form and your immediate environment and country, planet, solar system, beyond and beyond and beyond, and attempt to realize identicality in essence with whatever grand scope you may imagine, a feeling of cosmification comes over you in a way, a sense or feeling of cosmification comes, impresses itself upon consciousness. Cosmification. So the imagination can be used to grasp not only the existence of ever greater wholes, but one's identification as them, identicality with them. Well, I think one of the things we'll do is have, not at the moment, because this is mostly academic, but have some meditations on identification with ever greater wholes. This has to be cultivated, and in a sense, it is a kind of building of the antikarana, allowing us to perceive that which can only be perceived, perhaps, from the higher points of tension within our constitution. Now, here is where I begin to get into a little bit of verbally described mathematics, mostly of the relating to indeterminate forms. In other words, there's no sure answer to some of these things, and I simply offer a speculation concerning what thinking about the mathematics of infinity, the mathematical metaphysics of infinity may hint to us. Thus far, verbally, we've discussed this experience of ever greater identification, expanding our sense of being from this little self to the group, to the greater groups, to the planet, to the solus beyond, etc., until we get the sense of actually being the same as the ultimate entirety. Now, you know, you can't ask the concrete mind to do that, and you cannot ask those who are dominated by the emotion-fed, particularizing concrete mind to think there is any type of reality to such methods of identification. But maybe some are ready for this. Well, certainly some are ready for this. And through practice, in time, can move from apprehending the world of illusion to intimations of something that is beyond illusion. So there follows a mathematical, metaphysical, speculative discussion as an attempted elucidation. And not all statements will be explained at this time in illusion. I don't think I could explain some of the statements I make. I can offer what appears to be maybe a useful elucidation but it will not necessarily be so. It's just my intention. So let's say a few things here. Absoluteness, infinite essentiality, ultimatization is the absolute infinitude. The utterly infinitudinous infinitude. So, you know, in the mathematics of infinity, there are this scale of infinities. And each infinity becomes greater than the next. But then what is the absolute infinitude? And even the theorists that work with that kind of thought, they pull back when considering that and say, well, look, we can't really treat that. So what I want to say as a hypothesis is that there's nothing more infinite, to use crude terms, so to speak, than absolute infinitude, than the utterly infinitudinous infinitude. The infinity of all infinities, God infinite in an infinite number of ways. This was related to Spinoza's intuition on this matter in his six or so definitions at the beginning of his book, The Ethics. So there is this utterly infinitudinous infinitude, which I talked about as the complete consummation forever of all that ever could be. And now, whether you can, you know, is everything within it already enacted in every possible way that enactment could come? That's something we have to hold in our contemplation, but there are times when I want to say yes. Everything is enacted in any possible way that enactment in ignorance could develop. We enact so many things. We think we have free choice. We do, in a sense. A certain pattern emerges. Is that forever consummated in the absoluteness? In this series of discussions, I want to say yes, it is. I think in infinitization, I emphasize the fact that the absolute infinity was always infinitely far ahead of that which was enacted. Maybe it's the same thing. So we have to get this concept of the utterly infinitudinous infinitude. The maximally infinite. The infinitely infinite. I'll call it that. The infinitely infinite. And every time we think we're dealing with a special type of infinity, we find out that there's something still more infinite. But than this utterly infinitudinous infinitude, there is nothing more infinite. I just want to make that as a hypothesis. Than this utterly infinitudinous infinitude, there is no greater infinitude. Well, it staggers the mind, of course, because our mind wants to put boundaries on things, but we come right back to the first principle of the secret doctrine, the boundless, immutable principle. So, then, can we take whatever conception we have of this utterly infinitudinous infinitude or absolute infinitude and compare it with any item of relativity? Even a universe is an item of relativity, or an interval in the great breath is an item of relativity. Wherever relativity, wherever there is more than one, there is relativity. Now, In our practical world, we do want to learn how to relate. The Christ principle demands perfection of relationship. But we're not talking about that particularly right now, as necessary as it is to live properly and improve the illusion. So if we want to compare or contrast, then, you know, of course, in the poem of the Secret Doctrine, it says that this absoluteness is out of all relation with anything. Well, from that point of view, it has to be because it is everything. So you always need an other to relate to, and if there's no other, you can't relate. But that other appears in illusion. In other words, it's not really anything but the absolute infinitude, but it seems to be. So it's possible to relate a seeming to a reality. I'll put that down in a sense. We can relate a seeming to the one reality. Excuse me. Maybe I've been talking a bit too much today and kind of wonder how I'll ever conduct that full pre-full moon webinar with no voice. Okay, so we enter the task of comparing the utterly infinitudinous infinitude with an item of relativity, something that is produced through movement, in order to understand the temporal and spatial unreality of any such item, including a universe. I say including that item we call a universe, the temporal and spatial unreality of any such item of relativity, because we can say, well, you know, how does the universe relate to the interval between universes, or to the universe preceding, or to the universe succeeding? Relation is possible when speaking of that unity we call a universe. So, you know, we'll do the unthinkable thing of somehow comparing the item of relativity to absolute infinitude. And the another item of relativity is even the infinite series of universes, because look how many parts there are. Look how many numbers of things there are. They're all universes or intervals, but they're all different in a way. I'm not sure about duration. That has to be fathomed. We're in no position to understand what seven eternities are. If seven eternities relate to the slumbering of the Great Mother, or seven eternities to the appearance of the duration of the universe, a universe. We're in no position to know what those seven eternities are. Of course, is the Great Mother the ultimate mother, or is it something more local? In any case, we don't have that type of measurement. The greatest measurement we seem to have been given is the duration of all aspects of a solar system, not just the physical aspects, but for 311 trillion, 40 billion years in the Hindu chronology. And that's just a drop in the bucket, we know, so we're not given the really big numbers, especially the numbers that relate, or the number that relates to the span between universes. How long does the inhalation of the great breath last? How long is the higher interlude of the great breath? How long is the exhalation? How long is the lower interlude? All of those things probably have their enumeration. But the reason we want to make this comparison between any item of relativity and the absolute infinitude is to conclude something about the unreality of these items. Even what we call the great breath, as I have been emphasizing, is a motion. Well, we can say, you know, what is a motion in the immutable? Contradiction, it appears. If there is immutability, how does motion arise? Well, how does Maya arise? Does it arise? Does the universe ever arise? You know, somewhat insoluble problems, but we do have the great seeming, we do have the great Mahamaya, and with it, we, as emanative extensions of the One, have to deal. So we're going to make a comparison here, and what will this comparison show us? I'm saying here that it's necessary to determine the ratio between absolute infinitude and any finite quantity in illusion. That is, you know, anything that can be measured in terms of space or in terms of time. So we are contrasting the immeasurable with the measurable. And what will happen, well, you know, people will say, we can't do that, you know, but okay, for the sake of this illustration, I'm attempting to do that. I've already explained how even though the absolute is out of all relation with everything else, because it is everything else, it's not out of relation with, at least in terms of our illusory consciousness, with the items of illusion. The items that appear to us once division and multiplicity exist or arise. They do exist as actualities, but they are not real. But we want to compare these phantasms, this phantasmagoria, this presentation of distinctness, of distinct perceptions with the absolutely homogeneous infinitude. I think sometimes we should find ourselves inspired by the thought of this absolute infinitude. It doesn't do to just hold it as a concept. What we want also in time and space and in illusion is to have this great excitation, this inspiration which vibrationally lifts us closer to the being of the universal logos. All of these concepts, if they remain dry and if we fail to respond to them with any increase of frequency, they are not doing their job. So we're looking for a ratio. Well, and of course it will be a ratio which is not like other ratios, and it will lead to a certain kind of ambiguity or indeterminacy. And I'm just suggesting one result that it could lead to. And here, I suppose, my mathematical friends will say, oh, you've stepped over the boundary now. Well, I think I've always stepped over the boundary. You know, dealing with the subject of infinitude, you're always stepping over the boundary. So we'll see whether this holds some possibility. When any apparent quantity, as all quantities are only apparent, you know, the greatest of all, the absolute infinitude, is not a quantity. It's immeasurable. Hence, it's not the Mahamaya. The Mahamaya is measurable. Measurability characterizes all the appearances within it. But the great absolute infinitude is not measurable and has no quantity. Within the Mahamaya, there is quantity, which is always apparent, because anything in illusion is an apparency, an apparent. So when any apparent quantity, whether of time or of space, is compared to absolute infinitude, and we're allowing ourselves to imagine we can do this, that is, as it were, divided by absolute infinitude, the quotient is ever the result of the division is ever what I call the ultimate infinitesimal. That's the first time I'm introducing that concept, at least in this series of papers, introducing this term, the ultimate infinitesimal. A so-called quantity which is not zero, because then it would be nothing, and yet is smaller than any possible quantity. We assume that all quantity is measurable. So this ultimate infinitesimal is always smaller. We have a process of ever lessening. If we freeze this process of ever-lessenings at any point, we have a quantity which is not the ultimate infinitesimal. So it converges upon zero, but I say it never becomes zero. I say it becomes something else. Anyway, this may be an era of speculative mathematics in which differing conclusions vie for acceptance. So my speculative hypothesis is based upon a mixture of metaphysics and mathematics. I relate such speculations to what I call, nice title I think, the mathematical metaphysics of identification. There's metaphysics, and then you combine it with certain types of mathematics, and it should lead to a greater capacity to identify. So we're going to make a ratio here, and we're going to search for quotient by relating the dividend and the divisor. We will have a quotient, and that quotient I'm going to call the ultimate infinitesimal. Now, you know, you have to be maybe a genius in mathematics to deal with infinitesimal mathematics, and I can't do that. But I can speculate upon the metaphysical implications of certain of these mathematical states. My friend, of whom I spoke earlier, told me how many infinitesimals there are. And of course, that boggles the mind as well. But I'm always interested in absolutes. And just the way I'm interested in absolute infinitude, which sometimes is called zero, but I do not believe it should be called zero, I'm interested in the absolute infinitesimal, which I do not believe should be called zero either. So this ultimate infinitesimal, I'm calling it a so-called quantity which is not zero and yet is smaller than any possible quantity, ever smaller. And of course, we can go on forever subdividing. So what is this ultimate infinitesimal? So subdivision is continuous and converges upon zero. But I'm not saying that the ultimate infinitesimal is zero. I'm considering it something other than that, which is the nearest thing to nothing, and yet is not nothing. Something with no quantity, which is yet not nothing, because it is. Well, I may be on dangerous ground here, but I feel the need to relate some of these mathematical possibilities to our science of identification, or this method of evolving a dependable approach to achieve identification and ever greater intensities of identification. So conventional mathematics, albeit of a much higher kind, deems such an operation and its quotient as indeterminate. This I have to study. But some of the indeterminate forms, not necessarily all, are indicated in the following, and this is in the Wikipedia on the article Indeterminate Forms. The indeterminate forms include 0 to the 0th, 0 divided by 0. Now, what are they talking about here? Okay. 1 to the infinitith, infinity minus infinity, infinity divided by infinity, 0 times infinity, and infinity to the 0th. Usually things to the 0 power are themselves in conventional mathematics. And I'm assuming that among these indeterminate forms will be found any number, 1 or any number, divided by absolute infinitude. I assume the quotient is always the same. This is, for me, a kind of intuition. Is it correct? I don't know. But I think it may be to it that any definite quantity divided by absolute infinitude is the ultimate infinitesimal. And maybe any lesser infinitude than the absolute infinitude, when divided by the absolute infinitude, is also the ultimate infinitesimal. Now that is a really, I think, radical statement, because if you look at the mathematics of infinity, there are all kinds of infinitudes, but every one of them is lesser than the absolute infinitude. There are some amazing representations of the varieties of infinitudes. And they just seem to increase and increase. But I am proposing that any lesser infinitude, when divided by absolute infinitude, yields the ultimate infinitesimal. Shall I call it the absolute infinitesimal? I know this is not infinitesimal mathematics, as is followed by highly learned individuals with years and years of mathematical experience. But you see, I'm after the metaphysics of this. And really what I'm trying to do is move towards the definition of a point. See, we really haven't come up yet with what a point is, nor have we added points or an infinitude of points. We've mentioned this a little bit, but some of this mathematical speculation may lead us to what a point may be. So I call any specifiable, potentially measurable quantity a finite perceivable. All things really are perceived, perceivables. I believe that to be is to be perceived, which is, I suppose, a dictum of the idealistic philosophers. But I don't stay with that method of thinking entirely, but I do believe things are self-perceptions. The perceptions of a universal logos, that's what things are. And maybe a universe is a self-perception, a lessening self-perception of that. I've dealt with this in infinitization. So any universe too is a finite perceivable. It's infinite only in the sense that everything is the infinite, so that even an illusory thing must be essentially the infinite. But in terms of how it appears, it's a finite perceivable. But absoluteness, infinitessentiality, ultimatization, as the utterly infinitudinous infinitude, is not a finite perceivable. Every time you perceive something, you enumerate it. So I think that's correct. All perception enumerates. When you behold something in its entirety, it becomes a number one. Something beheld in entirety becomes a one. What we're calling here, this absoluteness, cannot be beheld in entirety. It can only be been. Well, I don't have words for it. You can only be it. You can't see it, you can't perceive it. So we might say that perception finitizes. Well, every specific quantity in illusion and all quantities are finite perceivables. They are, in their illusory state, appearing to be fundamentally different than that from which they came, that out of which they arose. Every finite quantity in illusion, just take any quantity that you're sure of, and it's a quantity in illusion, whether a quantity of time or of space, is a specifiable and apparently measurable, or measurable in apparency, or measurable in illusion. The absolute infinitude or utterly infinitudinous infinitude is always immeasurable. And interestingly, as I've said, one of the meanings of Maya is that which can be measured. So if you, well, you know, this gives us a kind of a postulate here. If it can be measured, it is not real. Just when we were thinking that anything measurable is real, that's how we operate in the normal world, but if it can be measured, it's not real. And I don't mean just what man can do now. I mean, if any being, great being, can measure something, then that which is measured is not real. The immeasurable, which is another way of saying the infinite, is real. The measurable is real. It's boundless. It's real. Well, friends, I've got a webinar coming up on Aquarius full moon. So what I'll say is that this is the end of simultaneity and sequence number 3. That's about 1 hour. And our date is still February the 13th. February 14th, 2014. And then we'll be beginning with simultaneity and sequence number 4. Hopefully tomorrow, maybe Valentine's Day. We can work on this, a day of relationship. And here I'm talking about everything that is not relationship. I'm using a kind of a preposterous relationship of the utterly infinitudinous to quantities in illusion to, in a sense, prove there is no relation, no real relationship, though there is actual relationship forever. Well, you know, to do these programs, one has to kind of warm up a bit. I sometimes look at what I've written and say, oh, no, I can never speak to this, because it takes a certain alignment to speak meaningfully about it. Otherwise, it's just words. The energy related to these thoughts has to be summoned. But I always hope that if I start talking, you know, third ray dictum, if the mouth is in motion, the thoughts will follow. If I do that, then some of the energy required to deal meaningfully with these ideas will follow. So we've begun our mathematical section, and we're talking about comparing or dividing any definite specifiable quantity by absolute infinitude. And although the results may be considered indeterminate, I'm proposing that what arises is a kind of quantitative cipher called an ultimate infinitesimal, which, though it has no dimension and no possibility of measuring it, still exists. That's going to be the key. And that's going to be what distinguishes it from zero. Because zero really is nothing, and this is something. I'm simply talking about zero at the low end of zero, and not the kind of zero that is sometimes attributed to be the identity of the absolute infinitude. Well, you know, I hate to give it up. I hate to stop with it, but it's necessary to get the mind into a different place in order to deal with these actual energies of the zodiacal constellation which are making themselves present at this time on our planet and in this very actual illusory state. So hopefully I can come back tomorrow and finish a bit of this. I think we're more than one-third through. And now that some of the foundational concepts are laid down, it may be possible to go a little faster, but as you can see, I'm dilating upon these things, trying to nest them in a context where they will be less formidable and seem more familiar, more approachable. They will seem to be concepts that we can deal with meaningfully in relation, eventually, to our everyday life. As I said, I will speak in ordinary terms, colloquial terms, but try to use those terms sometimes in a different way to indicate things that are not normally conceptualized and certainly not normally perceived. Okay? We'll see you. We'll be you. See you before long. Be you always.